What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, special operations military news, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to Soft Rep Radio. I'm your host today, Steve Balistrieri. Soft Rep Radio, on time, on target. We have a great show lined up for you this beautiful Friday morning. We have Kevin Morrow, who the author of a book we're going to be talking about, Rock Force, about the airborne invasion of the Corregidor in World War II. We're going to get into that. Kevin was, he's an award-winning journalist. He lives in North Carolina. He wrote the he co-wrote the book with Mark Owen, No Easy Day, this hand account of the mission that killed Osama bin Laden. He's written a couple other books. One of the ones I haven't read yet, I want to read that, is American Radical Inside the World of an Undercover, I'm tongue-tied this morning, Muslim FBI agent. He's covered the military for the past, I think, 16 or 17 years. He's been embedded with SF troops in the 82nd Airborne, as well as Navy SEALs in Afghanistan, Iraq, Haiti, and Africa. And I'm probably leaving out a couple of other countries, but we want to welcome him to the podcast. Mark, thank you very much for taking the time this morning. We really appreciate it.
No problem, Steve. I appreciate it.
Yes. Excuse me, Kevin. I just got off the phone with him, Mark. I apologize for that. Let's talk about this book, this Rock Force. What possessed you to write this story?
It's funny. I was searching for a new book to do, and I was up in New York at the Dutton offices, and I was talking to Brent, my editor up there, and he and I started talking about World War II books, and he was talking about his grandfather who jumped with the 503rd on Corregidor.
And oh, wow.
He said, look, I'd love to see a book about this. And I knew a little bit about Corregidor. I vaguely knew it was in the Philippines. I knew that it was an airborne operation, partly because of the Airborne Operation Museum in Fayetteville, North Carolina. It's got a mannequin dressed as one of the guys on all the gear. But I didn't really know much about the Pacific airborne operations because when I was covering the 82nd for the Fayetteville Observer, I really did a deep dive into their missions in the European theater. So I started poking around just to see if there was something there. And then I stumbled upon this treasure trove. This Australian guy, Paul Whitman, has a website that has everything to do with Corregidor. And the more I started unpacking it, the more I realized what an amazing story it was. So, you know, it was Brent's thread, but I was able to pull together kind of a great book. And then, you know, he did a masterful job editing it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because growing up, I've always been amazed with there's so many stories because obviously, you know, we're talking about the scope involved of World War II. And you talk about, you know, your editor, you know, saying his grandfather jumped on Corregidor. My own father fought in World War II. He was in armor in Europe. And, you know, my dad never talked about World War II. And we never knew what he did. But, you know, it wasn't until after he passed away that guys from his tank crew came to the wake and funeral and talking to my brother and my sister and I and said, you know, your father's in a book and you should research it. And so it got the juices flowing for myself. And it was kind of like the same thing. It was an eye-opening thing where I started reading this book. I'm reading about my own father and stuff I never knew. And I contacted some guys who were from Pennsylvania and they were with the Pennsylvania Guard, which was like the 28th Division. And reading about your father and then talking to guys who were there during this battle that took place was it's an amazing journey, I guess you could say. And that's awesome that you did this because that's one of the battles, you know, being a paratrooper myself and a special forces guy, I love reading about the airborne stories. And that's one of the ones that really hasn't been talked about that much, has it?
It really hasn't. And you know, for guys who have jumped out of a plane, you know, you'll appreciate this. I mean, these were small drop zones and they weren't using these modern parachutes that you can steer. It wasn't like, you know, some of the stuff that special operations can do now. You know, these guys were jumping at 300 feet on a small golf course in a small parade field and covered in debris. I mean, they had bombed the island for weeks. So it was, you know, craters and, you know, rebar sticking out and, you know, it was a treacherous drop zone to jump in. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't these big fields like you see in Holland at Market Garden or something like that. So just that was pretty spectacular. And the fact that they jumped into the middle of the defenses, you know, the idea initially when Jones looked at the island's shaped like a tadpole. It's the best way to think of it, right? It has this long tail that comes out of this really bulbous head that is a mountain. And so they initially were going to jump onto the tail, which is there's an airfield at the end of the island on the tail. But that defeated the purpose because they would have to have fought over two hills to actually take topside, which is what the top of the hill of Corregidor was called. And so instead, they just jumped into the middle of the Japanese defenses. And the Japanese were really set up to repel an amphibious assault because that's how they had taken the island a couple years before.
Yeah, and that was one of the fascinating parts of the book. I had heard about the airborne drop in Corregidor, but I hadn't really studied it very, very well. And then to find out reading the book that it was, the drop zone was only a couple of seconds long and it was really narrow where if they were off by just the slightest bit, the guys ended up in the trees right in the middle of Japanese positions, which some of them unfortunately did. That is incredible. And jumping from 300 feet. I mean, I've jumped from 750 at times we've jumped as low as 500. I can't imagine what it must be like jumping from 300 feet. That alone is one of those things that make you step back and appreciate the guys who did that.
One of my favorite stories though too is the correspondent that jumps with Tony Lopez. You know, they break the chalks up and he's got his small chalk. He's not a jump master. He's given his own chalk to do, and he's got this guy who's never jumped before, and they put the parachute on him, and they just kind of shove him out like a bundle. He's the one that lands, if you remember it in the book, and I don't want to spoil too much of it, but he's the one that lands okay, where Tony actually gets hung up in the trees, and it's this guy that's never jumped before that actually helps him get out of the trees.
Yeah. That was a good part of the book, and I love that, because then Tony goes, help me out of this, you know, and it was like...
Yep.
And something you can appreciate, having been embedded with the 82nd and SF, I mean, can you imagine if they had just thrown a parachute on you and said, hey, we're going to land on a postage-sized DZ. You're going in with us, and don't worry about it. We'll make sure you get out there on time. That's crazy.
It's funny you bring that up, too, because for a while there, I was talking to the 82nd a little bit. You know, being that you've been at Fort Bragg, you know, the 82nd's always gearing up. They're always ready. They're always this 18-hour, you know, we can be anywhere, we can jump. And I was talking to their public affairs shop for a while there about going to jump school and writing a story, but actually going through jump school so that I was I had at least the five jumps I needed to be airborne qualified. So that if they ever did do it, that I could be like some of the World War II correspondents and jump. I didn't think it would ever come to fruition, but we talked about it for maybe a hot minute, seriously, but I don't think it ever got to be really serious. But I always thought when I was covering the 82nd that would have been like the ultimate embed, is to actually go with them out the door.
That's amazing. Yeah, because you think back to, there was guys who jumped with the 82nd in Sicily and, mm-hmm. I believe in Normandy as well. I think a couple of correspondents actually jumped with them into Normandy. I know one did in Holland. So, I mean, hats off to those guys, because it's hard enough jumping when you're well-trained to do it for the first time into combat. And, you know, especially in Corregidor, I mean, you talk about how small the drop zone is, full of rebar and shell craters, and of course, you're landing on top of a 4,500 man strong Japanese garrison who, let's face it, the rules of war didn't really apply to them.
No, I mean, that's the other thing that took me aback a little bit is just how nasty this fight is. I mean, it was, you know, Corregidor wasn't an easy place to fight. It was well fortified because, you know, the Americans had poured tons of money and effort into fortifying Corregidor. That's why it was, you know, the rock, this fortress in the mouth of Manila Bay. And so, you know, having to take it back was hard because there were so many tunnels and places where defenders could really dig in and hold the ground. And so what you find as you go through this book is this really, really nasty, hard fight. And it takes a toll on the guys. And I think one of the things that I got most excited about as I was writing this book is I was able to find these unpublished manuscripts that really give you an inner monologue. So you really get a sense, unlike some history books, that of what these guys were thinking, you know, what they were praying at night and how they were feeling. And I think that intimacy is what I was really trying to drill down on, because I really wanted the reader to be able to walk patrols with these guys and sort of experience this battle as close as they could.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the fascinating things in the book, because not only do you were able to weave the story of the overall operation and the thought behind it strategically, okay, you know, we're going to retake Corregidor. This was a place where the U.S. suffered a humiliating defeat in 1942. So they wanted their, you know, revenge against the Japanese for that. But the personal stories that you were able, and I want to talk to you a little bit about that. You're weaving in these personal stories, what's going on in these guys' head as all this is going on. That's the best part of the book, I thought, was the fact that, you know, we've all read kind of, I don't want to say sanitized, but it is kind of sanitized history. Oh, this company took this area and all this, but you're not getting the personal side of it. And to hear these guys' stories, that must have been very, very time consuming putting all that together.
It was, but I was sort of treated as if I was embedded with the 503rd. And I tried to think of it like, how would I tell this story if it was happening now or if I was getting it right after the fact? And that sort of framed what I was doing. I also really forgave myself for not getting into the bigger muscle movements of the battle. I mean, I pretty much give you a sense that there was an amphibious assault with other soldiers. I don't really get into the details of that. I don't get into the details much beyond, you know, really one company, one platoon even with Calhoun. And I did that on purpose because I wanted that intimacy. I didn't really want there's other books that are written about Corregidor that will give you the big muscle movements and will show you, you know, the really tactical maps. And for the guys that really enjoy that, those books exist. I think this book, as I was trying to be a little more accessible to folks who want to learn a little bit of World War II history, but they want to learn it in a way that has a real human, you know, a human aspect to it, but also reads like a novel and reads a little bit like an adventure book, which gives them this kind of propulsion through the story.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think once we all experienced that, going back to like there was the book and then later the miniseries Band of Brothers, I think people really enjoyed that kind of a story. Not only, yeah, we all know what happened in Holland, you know, but now you're hearing the stories of these individual paratroopers and what they're all about and where they're from. And I thought you did a great job of weaving all that into the story of the actual battle there. And so how long did this take you to put all this together? Because it had to have been time consuming trying to track all these guys down.
It was. I really owe a debt to Paul Whitman, who runs the Corregidor, basically the Corregidor historical site that has all the battle orders, everything. He was just a wealth of information. I actually went to Corregidor with him, and we walked the scenes that I include in the book. So I basically did a tour of where Calhoun was throughout the battle, where Bradford was, where some of these characters were. I spent a lot of time right there on top of that magazine, at sort of the climax of the book, where the Japanese run a bonsai attack to try to take Topside back. And I spent a lot of time there in that gully where MacArthur holds off the Japanese and eventually is awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions. So I did a lot of traveling and tried to get on the ground quite a bit, but Whitman had pulled together a lot of this. And then I traveled to Texas and met Calhoun's daughter, and she was able to provide me with, I actually still have it, a dot matrix printed off with his handwritten notes of this manuscript that he wanted to write about his experience. And I was able to merge these together. So the research was consuming in that sense, but Paul had really done like the big, he had dragged the net onto the beach, right? I just got to go through and pick the fish I wanted. So he really, I owe him a debt on a lot of that.
Yeah. Now does Corregidor, I mean, you know, where those enormous gun batteries and all that concrete, is that all still pretty much intact there?
It is. And you can really, I mean, we were into some of these tunnels, you know, Paul really took me into the depths. We went into Battery Wheeler quite a bit, which is a spot early in the battle where Calhoun has to take it and the Japanese hold it. And it's a massive battery, you know, massive concrete battery, which you can walk all through that, climb all through it. I mean, Corregidor, for folks who are interested in battlefields and going and seeing battlefields, Corregidor is a special battlefield. They haven't overdeveloped it. It's not. They do have a tour, but they also will allow you basically to hike through there. I mean, I spent a week there and we hiked all over, like up and down into the jungle. We hiked down. There's a part in the book where Calhoun gets ambushed by the Japanese as they're clearing one of the ravines. And I walked that ravine. I mean, I saw where all that happened. And it's not that much. That's not changed that much. Same with where Lopez spends that his first night on Corregidor, and he ends up crawling up on that balcony and shooting those guys. You know, that place is still there. So I mean, it's an amazing place to walk, and I'm hoping that what'll happen is people will enjoy Rock Force, will be interested in seeing more of Corregidor, and then maybe there's a chance where, you know, people who can get to Corregidor can get a better sense of really what happened.
Oh, that's awesome. I would love to see that because it's like one of those places now, you know, you read about and everything, the way it initially played out with the Japanese and, you know, invading, they took a really bloody nose trying to take it the traditional way, the seaborne assault, and then the Americans deciding they were going to vertically envelop it using airborne forces, and it totally took them by surprise. So it's one of those places, I think, if you're a military historian or just a history buff, it would be a great place to go. I mean, it's one of those battlefields you have to put on your bucket list, wouldn't you say?
Oh, hell yeah. I would go back there in a heartbeat. I mean, what I like about it, too, is it like I did the tour, and the tour was pretty good. You know, they give you a good sense of what happened. You go into Malinta Tunnel where, you know, MacArthur was holed up, and a lot of the Americans were holed up early, and then the Japanese were holed up there at the end of the battle in 45. But what I like most about it is there is a sense of adventure to it. They will allow you to go walk around in there, and I think that's where I think it becomes one of these bucket list battles, because it, you know, it gives you a real sense, and you can kind of get really hands-on to what you're seeing and what those guys experienced.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Now, you know, this is might seem like an odd question. Is it harder to put together a historical book like this where, you know, you're 75 years after the fact? Or is it harder to put together a story like you're doing, like with the Navy SEAL book with Mark Owen, because a lot of the intelligence that you're dealing with is still maybe classified?
I think it's harder to do the 75-year book for a couple reasons.
Is it?
For one, you know, there's a lot of open source stuff around the World War II stuff, so that the research is a little easier. But I'm working on another World War II book now, and what I find interviewing World War II veterans is that they just don't want to get into it. Or if they do want to get into it, they don't really want to get into the action stuff, right? Most soldiers, and I'm sure you're like this too, you know, you don't want to tell the stories about the action stuff. But, you know, when I interview them and I ask them, modern soldiers can tell you what happened, and they tell it with a much more of a cinematic flair, because I think we all grew up on movies. So mm-hmm. They can tell the story. I actually often will ask them, like, tell me the story like it was a movie in your head. Like, when you close your eyes and see the scene, tell me what those scenes are. it's a lot harder for some of the older veterans, particularly around World War II. They just don't have that same touch point, right? We all grew up on TV and movies. They didn't. So I find it easier to do the modern, get guys to tell me modern retelling of what happened than I do the World War II stuff.
Yeah, it's funny because, again, I mean, even my mother, my father didn't talk about his World War II experiences, like the bad stuff, you know, that he had seen. And, of course, fighting in armor in you know, Western Europe in 44 and 45 wasn't a very pleasant experience. But, you know, he would only talk about funny things. And you mentioned that in the book. A lot of vets talk about funny things or, you know, people, their friends, and stuff that isn't too, I guess, in depth, you know, when it comes to the fighting part. I think that was just their generation of how they handle things. But I thought that the personal stories you told of all these guys and what they were thinking, that had to have been really difficult to pry it out of some of these guys, wouldn't it?
Well, I only really got to talk to Lopez. You know, Calhoun had passed, Bradford had passed already. And so I was only able to really get it from them.
Yeah, but they had written about what they were thinking. Yeah, and you got all that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, those manuscripts that I was able to get a hold of were invaluable. And Paul, you know, Paul helped pointing me to those manuscripts and getting me copies of them. I mean, that they provide you, Bradford in particular was a really great writer and really eloquent in the way that he could retell sort of his inner monologue. And then Calhoun's manuscript, what I liked about Calhoun's manuscript, you know, Calhoun, I always used to joke when I was writing the book, is Calhoun is my Dick Winters, right? He is the guy that you have to, as the reader, like and want to follow. And he is really your platoon leader as you go through this story. And and I think the how raw he writes about his experience. And I think what I most valued about his insights into Craig Orr is this sense of loss that he has. I think too often we look at World War II and think, well, they, you know, of course they understood the greater good they were doing, right? But I think he gives you this sense of, you know, the soda straw view of the sacrifice that he has to make and the toll of losing his soldiers, you know, weighs heavy on him. And when he leaves Corregidor, you know, Corregidor is a success. They take Corregidor back. They accomplish their mission. And yet when he leaves, you get that sense that, you know, he's trying to weigh that the toll of completing his mission, you know, what it cost him. And I think that's important. And I don't think we often in World War II books, I don't know if we go far enough in trying to explain that, you know, this wasn't done without taking a toll on the soldiers that did it. And the reason why they often don't want to talk about it is that, you know, these battles were horrific. And what they had to do to survive them is something they just don't want to do again.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, especially, you know, fighting the Japanese, where there was absolutely no quarter given. And they didn't even at times they had to leave their dead behind, knowing what was going to happen to them if the Japanese found them. And you mentioned in the book, there was a couple of guys who had to get left behind because of, you know, firefights that were ongoing, and their bodies were never found. The Japanese pulled them away and they never found those guys. And that's the kind of sad, and, you know, it talks about the cost of these. And these guys were under no illusions because they knew the Japanese weren't going to quit. And they were, you know, now the Corregidor's over, they're looking at further on operations, maybe on Japan itself.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. I mean, I think that was weighing on them. And then it's funny, if you remember, as you read the book, you know, there's a couple instances where, like you said, where just because of the situation, they just could not recover the fallen paratroopers. But do you notice too that often they would have dreams about them, right? And the guys would always come back and be like, "Hey, you left me." I thought that was very interesting that it wasn't an isolated incident, but I think a lot of the soldiers had this guilt. But they also pragmatic and understood that they had to weigh everything. I that's what I'm most proud of in this book, I'll be honest. I think there's real courage in what some of these men wrote about their experiences, and I think there's real courage in acknowledging, you know, these kind of hard decisions and the toll they take on you.
Yeah, and you know, it was funny you mentioned just a moment ago about Calhoun being kind of like the Dick Winters of this unit. The guy I was really fascinated with, obviously, besides Calhoun, was Lloyd McCarter. And when I was reading the book, I'm kind of picturing him. I don't have a picture of him, but in my mind, I was picturing him as kind of the Bill Garnier of the 503rd there. He was a really fascinating character, and it was sad to hear how his life turned out after the fact.
Yeah, Lloyd McCarter is one of my favorites. I wanted to know more about Lloyd McCarter. I just couldn't find more, but I also think part of what makes him such a great character and such a great human is that you just don't know that much about him. But yeah, he has a tragic end, but he's the and you know this probably from your own service, he's that classic soldier who's just an amazing soldier and a great unit mate. You know, he's a great guy to have in your unit, but he's just bad at sitting idle and bad at being around the flagpole. You know, he's bad at formation. But man, if you're in a fight, he's the guy you want. And I think, you know, those are special soldiers. And I think, you know, to Calhoun's credit, the fact that they fought hard to get his recognition for what he did, I think speaks to just how important he was, and how his service was valued by his unit mates.
Yeah, I think McCarter's one of those guys, and he's like that classic guy that every commander wants him in their unit during combat, and they want to get rid of him as soon as they get back to garrison.
I mean, it's funny how some of the tropes work, right? Like you know, if I told you I was writing a book about an airborne unit, and one of the guys is a rough and tumble lumberjack who, you know, disappears all the time to go fight with other units because he just doesn't want to not be in combat. But then, you know, when they pull him out of the brig just in time to jump onto this island that they're going to fight, and they think it's only 800 guys and it's really 6,000, you'd tell me, like, that's ridiculous, man. Be like, that's fiction. But again, this is where, like, nonfiction is so powerful, in that, you know, there's a reason why fiction writers use these tropes, is because the reality is that, you know, this happened, and Lloyd McCarter and Bill Calhoun are, you know, that personified.
Yeah, and I was, you know, fascinated reading about what happened after the fact to Charlie Bradford and Chet. Is it Nycom or Nycom?
Nycom, yeah.
Nycom, yeah. Those guys, I mean, again, the characters in the book are so strong, and that's what was, I mean, it's just it was a page turner once you get started. You know, there was some Miss Meals involved in there, and I thought you did a great job with that, because you just kept turning the page after page after page, and I thought it was a great book. And again, I mean, kudos, you know, to anyone who goes through this kind of, you know, I think investigation of putting stuff like this together. I especially love reading this World War II history.
Well, thanks. No, I mean, it's a trick. It's something I learned when I wrote No Easy Day. You know, mm-hmm. We wrote that one backwards. So I started on chapter 9 when Mark Owen learns about the existence of this mission, and then I followed it all the way to the end. And then I wrote the chapters that lead to the raid second. And I did that because I wanted to figure out who was important in the raid that I needed to make sure that the reader knew about, so that when the raid starts, we never have to stop and give you an explanation on who they are. And so I tried to take that a little bit into this book as well, in that I just didn't want it to get slow. I wanted you to have just enough information to understand what they were getting into. But, you know, once the airborne operation starts, man, it's on. And so, you know, that was a kind of a deliberate trying to cut the fat off of it and make it as sort of a, you know, a straight line through as fast as I could do it.
Yeah. So what was it like actually meeting, you know, Lopez and getting to talk with him a bit?
It was great because I got to meet two guys who jumped on Corregidor, and it was great to meet both of them, only because, you know, I wanted that human connection. It's one thing to take extrapolate off a page, but it's another thing to really talk to them. But the most value that I got from talking to guys that actually jumped was talking about other guys. You know, the action itself was pretty laid out, right? But getting to talk about, like, talk to Lopez about, you know, Ed Flash, who was his platoon leader, or talk to Lopez about Bill Calhoun, or or some of the other guys, that was where it was most valuable. And you could see him, you know, he sort of lit up when he started talking about the other guys. That was the most valuable part.
Yeah, you even get some manuscript from one of the Japanese side. And I know I'm going to butcher his name, Yoshiharu Nonaka, I think it is.
Well, that was I actually reached out to a couple different researchers and I was able to find one who was an expert on Japan, and he through his research dug that one out. I really, when I went into the project, was hoping to get a Japanese narrative and be able to run a parallel narrative. So as while you followed Calhoun and the rest of the guys, you also going to follow a Japanese soldier, but there really isn't that much out there. A lot of the guys, were killed. The Japanese defenders, for the most part, were killed. The ones that did survive, I mean, there wasn't a lot of writing about what had happened on Corregidor. So the fact that we found that it's like a 3-page document was the best I could do. But I thought, for the best I could do, it was pretty illuminating. It was a pretty good look at what it was like to be a foot soldier in the Imperial Japanese Army and sort of that struggle as well.
Yeah, because, you're looking at it from their perspective. They're gearing up for a seaborne invasion, and then all of a sudden they're seeing aircraft dropping paratroopers on top of them. I mean, from their perspective, that had to have been terrifying. I mean, granted, we know how they fought and we know how they died. In fact, you just mentioned how hard it is to get any narrative. I mean, almost 4,500 of them died there. I think 119 were taken prisoner. That was it. So, yeah, the opportunities there are obviously quite limited. Now, after all this many years, it's got to be non-existent. But now this was such a good book. And again, to our readers that are listening out there, I can't recommend this one enough. I mean, this was a really, for people who love World War II history and then to get the personal stories involved, we can't recommend this one enough. And is there anyone you'd like to mention about who helped you along with this? I know you mentioned Whitman, and is there anyone else you'd like to talk about that helped along with this project?
I mean, there's tons of people that helped, but Whitman was a huge asset. And then Brent, my editor, Brent, he made this book better. About the middle of the writing of this book, Hurricane Florence hit Wilmington. I ended up covering that for 10 days and that derailed a lot of the book. So the book that you read really has a lot to do with what Brent did and really how he edited this book. But it was a unique experience because he was editing it, one, as a doing his job, but I think he had a real emotional connection to it because of his grandfather. And I think that comes through. And I think, while I'm catching a lot of accolades, and it was very kind of you to say the things you just said about the book, I think, the same goes to Brent and the work that he did to make the book what we have right now.
Well, on a personal note, you've been embedded with a bunch of different units. Is there any stories that, you lived through that stand out as maybe one of the better ones that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I don't know, man. It's funny. I mean, I've got stories here and there, but for the most part, I took my job. I tried to always try to be like as close to Ernie Pyle as I could, right? I wanted to be closest to the guy that had to do the job. I wasn't all that interested in the guy that ordered the job to be done. I wanted the guys to be around the guys that had to do it. I don't know. My first ever embed, I got to Kuwait. The 82nd was just getting ready to go across the border. And we were like the last plane in. It was me and Steve Aber, a photographer at the time that was working at the Fayetteville Observer. And then just a quick story is we get there, we run over to this resort to get fitted with our mop gear, right? So in case we get slimed by some sort of chemical agent, we'll have a gas mask. We have the gear we have to get. And so this reserve guy looks at me and he says, "You look like about a large." He hands me this vacuum sealed top and bottom pair of pants and a hooded jacket you wear rubber gloves. And he hands me this gas mask and he says, "When you hear the sirens, man, just put the gas mask on and run into what the closest bunker, just follow the crowd. And that was the only training I had for any kind of chemical agent if we had been hit by it. And so when we get to Kuwait, we get to the 82nd base, we're getting ready to drive up to this town in southern Iraq. And I go to put on the mop gear, because we all had to wear this mop gear before we went across the border. And the sleeves of my jacket cut about my forearm. Like, they don't go all the way. And so I have these camo, strangely, all the paratroopers were given BDU-style camouflage mop suits, and we were given desert camouflage-style mop suits. So I go to the chemical officer at the 82nd, at the 325th Airborne Infantry Regiment, and I say, hey, man, I need a bigger jacket. So he gives me a bigger jacket. So I show up, and you know this as a soldier. I show up to the Humvee I'm assigned to ride in to Iraq that night. In my mop gear like everybody else, and I'm wearing desert camouflage pants and a green jacket, and they let me have it because I was like the rock star, right? Like I was like two-tone, matched it up. But yeah, I was convinced that if we had gotten hit with chemical agent at all, I was dead. I just didn't have any training. I didn't know what I was doing, and I was dressed like I picked it off the rack.
Yeah, I hated wearing that stuff. I can tell you that. I remember we once had a commander that thought it was a really good idea to do a 12-mile road march in the middle of the summer, during the middle of the day, and wearing all that stuff. And I remember my mask kept filling up with water, which was sweat, and you'd have to break the seal of your mask, drip the water out, and keep going. I hated wearing that stuff. So I definitely sympathize with that. And of course, being an SF guy, I wanted to ask you what it was like being embedded with the SF guys, because I know that for the most part, they aren't usually too friendly with the news guys.
You know, I one of the tricks I use whenever I embed with SF guys is I never take my, I keep my notebook in my pocket for 24 hours. And I have the whole team sit down and I basically explain to them how this is going to work. Essentially, you know, what off the record means, what on background, on background means that they, if I have my notebook out, I'm looking for them to quote them. If I don't have my notebook out, they're free to say whatever they want. If they say something that to me while I don't have my notebook out and I want to use it later, I will come back to them and say, you said this, I'd like to use this. Are you okay with me using it? And once they know the ground rules and you keep up, right? The mm-hmm. SF teams always do the same thing. They take you out and show you all the weapons, and they say, hey, have you ever fired this? Have you ever fired that? You know, and they want to teach you, because you know SF guys are teachers at heart, and they teach you all about the weapons. That makes them feel better. And then if you just shut up and follow along, and you just watch and you keep up, sooner or later they'll want to talk to you. They want to build some rapport, and then after that rapport building starts, you know, I'm usually in good shape. But I like to lay out the ground rules pretty early. I wrote a book called Gentlemen Bastards with a 7th group team out of Fort Bragg at the time before they moved to Florida. And, you know, I spent 10 weeks with that team. And by the time I got to the end with that team, you know, I was just part of the team. I was no different than like the JTAC or somebody else that was attached to them. They just got used to seeing me. But, you know, for the times I've had to hit it, you know, in a week or a couple days, I just find it easier to be utterly transparent and make sure everybody's on the same page.
Yeah, absolutely. And 7th Group, that was my old stomping ground. So that's awesome. But I don't want to take up any more of your time. It's almost the weekend here. And I really want to thank you for taking the time and joining us this morning. You know, we really appreciate you doing that. We appreciate your time and all the work that you've done. Like I said, I can't recommend this book to our listeners any more so than I already have. And we've actually written a book review on your work there. It'll come out as soon as we do the podcast. We'll kind of double dip it a little bit there to bring some attention to it. I think this is something that everyone should read if you're a military historian. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners before we decide to wrap this up?
No, I really appreciate you talking to me. I thank you so much for the kind words and, you know, keep up the good work over there. I mean, you know, you guys are doing a service and covering down on the military. And so I just appreciate it. And I appreciate you giving me a few moments to kind of sell the book and talk about this important story. So I appreciate it.
Well, we really appreciate it. And, you know, we call ourselves journalists, but we're still grunts at heart. So we really like reading stuff like this. This was really, really enjoyable. It was a great book. And again, thanks again for your time. But before we go, just a quick announcement. If you want to get SoftRep on your phone, download our free mobile app and get easy access to our articles, podcasts, and gear reviews, all perfectly formatted to your device. Please subscribe to SoftRep.com. Get all of your access to our library of eBooks and our exclusive team room forums and content available on all Apple and Android devices. So this will wrap it up. For myself, Steve Balestrieri, we want to thank our guest, Kevin Mara, for joining us today. It was a tremendous book. Again, folks, Rock Force, check it out. Make sure you download it. We'll be back with another podcast here real soon. SoftRep Radio on time, on target. Thanks for listening, folks. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back real soon.
You've been listening to SoftRep Radio.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
You've probably heard a lot about electrified vehicles lately. Well, Toyota has electrified options for every lifestyle. We've got hybrids, no plug needed.
All right, let's go.
But we also have plug-in hybrids, if that's your thing. You can even go 100% electric in the Toyota BZ4X. With so many options for reducing carbon emissions, Toyota is electrified, diversified. Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.